From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the horror mystery Escape Room, directed by Adam Robitel, starring Taylor Russell and Logan Miller. Communion, a Polish documentary. Also, The Vanishing, starring Gerard Butler and Peter Mullen. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
And by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards, including Lead Actress Olivia Colman, Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope things are going well at the start of your weekend. I'm joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson and Wade Major. Amy writes for The Guardian and hosts the podcast The Canon and Unspooled. Wade Major of Synagogues.com. We begin with Escape Room, starring Taylor Russell, Logan Miller, and Deborah Ann Wall. It's directed by Adam Robitel and written by Bragi Schutt and Maria Melnick. Wait, what'd you think of Escape Room?
Oh, not much, but I really, really do like parts of it. It has two of my favorite actresses in it, Deborah Ann Wall of Daredevil and Taylor Russell, who plays Judy on The New Lost in Space, both on Netflix. I adore them both. They're both wonderful actresses, and they kind of saved the movie for me. Whenever they're on screen, I just thought it was terrific. I was thoroughly engaged, and then I remembered, oh, this is another one of those movies. This is, you know, six strangers get a little box, and they get invited to some game called, hey, we make escape rooms. You know, it's kind of like a real-life video game where you have to find the clues in the game and figure out how to get out, and oh, no, they soon realize it's like a giant corporate snuff film, and they're going to die, and this is somebody's amusement who's watching them in these sequences of elaborate rooms try to figure out how to save themselves, which is that whole, in the more sophisticated we get as people, how primal are we really? What does it take to push a person to become primitive? And we've seen that in the Hunger Games and the Saw films, and Agatha Christie wrote about it, and Then There Were None, and, you know, James Gunn did the Belko experiment, a script he wrote a couple of years ago. It's all the same stuff. And it's really well done. It's very elaborately directed. But at the end of the day, it's another one of those movies, and it's just kind of dumb.
Escape Room, Amy.
Yeah, I was absolutely horrified when I found this movie existed. I thought, oh no, you know, I love escape rooms, and now we're getting turned into a Saw franchise. What's happening? I will say several things to its credit. This film is not that violent or gory or bloody at all. You know, it's much more.
That's true. It's a lot less than you would have expected.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's much more based in suspense. And I don't want to give away any of the rooms for people, but my, they are so inventive. The production design on this film is just fantastic. It's sort of like Bad Times at the El Royale, another film where you're like, wow, they put in so much effort into this movie. I was dazzled from scene to scene. Every time they went to a new room, I was like, I can't wait to see how they're going to escape and if they can and what this room is going to be. You know, it's got a lot of tropes that I tend to roll my eyes at. You know, the very perfect, traumatized, genius college girl who's just great at all puzzles. And when somebody says, oh, it must be a 7-letter word with who's a presidential name, she can list like 12 of them right away. You know, women like that, characters like that, I always find a little grating. But I was happy to see my character that I was happy to see show up was Taylor Levine, or Tyler Levine, who's been in so many great little horror films. And
true.
Here, I think, is just fantastic. This movie is fun. It won me over.
And they are definitely going to turn it into a franchise. And if this gives anything away, you need your head examined. Taylor Russell is just terrific, and yes, she survives because her face is on the poster. If you think that she's not going to survive, you need an IQ adjustment. This seriously is it may improve as a franchise over time if they continue to make her the center of it, and that appears to be what they're doing, so I'm very happy about that.
And if I can say something insane for a second, if anybody listening out there is really into escape rooms, the absolute best ones I've ever been to in the country, or in the planet, on the world, are in Kiev, Ukraine.
Really?
I'm just saying.
Really?
They are unreal. I would tell you a 700-minute story about this one that involved making toast with Cyrillic on it, but I don't want to bore anybody. I'm just saying, escape room people, If this movie doesn't do it for you, get a plane ticket
to
Kiev.
Go to Ukraine. All right. Escape Room, rated PG-13. It's in wide release. Communion, Polish documentary directed by Anna Zemecka. Amy?
Yeah, this film is a really lovely, depressing, slow burn. I enjoyed it very, 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 very much. Wade seems traumatized.
I'm so traumatized.
But what it's about is there's a young girl. She's in her early teens. She has a preteen younger brother who we are introduced to in a scene where he can't figure out the belt buckle on his pants. And, you know, we can diagnose him as audience members, you know, maybe as having like some sort of spectrum disorder, but the film never acknowledges it. What it does acknowledge is the work that this daughter does to keep her brother in line, because she's in this family where the dad is drunk and on the couch and refuses to even babysit his own son, and the mother is off. She's started a new family. So this is a documentary where this young girl is just under so much pressure to keep her family together, and the driving arc of it is her little brother keeps failing communion. He's not allowed to take his communion because he isn't passing the sacrament by the church, this quiz. And so she thinks if she can get him to pass communion and get his first communion, then the mother will come, then the family will be reunited. And it's this, like, childish but yet practical determination that she has. It's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's very, very effective. This is one of, you know, two Eastern, very depressing Eastern European docs that we have this week, both of them on the Academy's 15 film shortlist for the Oscars. Both, I think, have a little bit of interference from the filmmakers, which is problematic for me. It's not too problematic here. I mean, this is a real family with real problems, and problems that we can't even imagine that are you know, cultural, genetic, whatever. It's all of the above. But you can't help but absolutely feel for this girl. The burden that she carries every single day is just crushing. The communion thing was actually introduced by the filmmaker. That's the one thing I have a little bit of a problem with. The filmmaker wanted to give the family something to work toward, something that would give their daily activities some kind of a narrative structure that she could build a film around. And she suggested maybe he should try to get his communion again. He'd already been rejected, I think, once. And then she suggested they go for that. And that became a thing that they were going to work toward so she could sort of shape the movie around that. I'm a little bit apprehensive about filmmakers doing that just so that they can make a movie. I would have much preferred to sort of see what their lives would have been like had she not stepped in and suggested something that would be a goal to work toward.
What is lovely, though, is like there is one flashback of the mother herself, you know, who's such an off-camera presence for most of the film.
Yeah.
And it's the mother herself at her own communion, getting ready for her communion. And you see this young girl who we've been kind of demonizing as an older woman alone trying to zip up her dress, and her own mother walks in and doesn't help her zip it up. And you get this sense and this really quick glimpse that they just happen to find of a family that's had this trauma passed on. She was not raised, and now she's not raising, and now this poor girl is doing all the work.
Communion, the documentary from Poland, as Wade just mentioned, it is on the Academy's short list, one of 15 films under consideration for the Best Feature Documentary nominees. Communion is screening Saturday only at Lemley's Playhouse and Lemley's Monica Film Center Theaters, and it's at Lemley's Glendale Theater through January 10th. The movie is unrated. The Vanishing stars Gerard Butler, Peter Mullen, and Connor Swindles. Christopher Nyholm is the director, and the screenplay of The Vanishing, written by Joe Bone and Kellen Jones. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, this is your cold weather, chilly thriller of the weekend. The setup here is three lighthouse keepers are on this tiny island. Gerard Butler is one of them, going full accent, which is my favorite Gerard Butler. Everyone has giant beards, bushy sweaters, and one day a body washes ashore along with a bar of gold. And what are they going to do about it? You know, they make one bad decision and then they're forced into a series of bad decisions from there. So this is a film where everything just spirals out of control, and the three men are looking to each other for who can they trust. And they're looking at the dark water beyond, what's going to come to their island from there. You know, this film, it has just sort of a lot of gothic thriller tropes. You know, I wouldn't say it was totally shocking from scene to scene, but what I enjoyed about it is it has a huge heavy amount of guilt. You know, you really feel the weight of all their decisions that they're making. You know, on the one hand, this feels just sort of like a nice little thriller to warm you up during the weekend, which I think is basically what it is. But I do admire that, you know, the filmmaker himself, that Christopher Nyholm, this is his directorial debut. He's working with something ambitious here. He's got good ideas. So I'm excited to see what he does after this film.
And we should say this is not to be confused with the previous films with the name The Vanishing. It's been a popular name for films. This has nothing to do with it.
Not at all. That's a good point. And I also wanted to say, even for Communion, if you try to buy tickets for Communion this week, they have the poster of the Christopher Walken movie online on Google Tickets. So I'm just saying,
boy, that's confusing.
Look out, y'all.
Okay. All right. The Vanishing at the AMC Universal City Walk Theater. It's rated R. Also, this week on Film Week, The Distant Barking of Dogs, which is a Danish documentary directed by Simon Lering Vilmont. Amy.
Yeah, this is set in Ukraine. It's set specifically in a very small village that's 1 mile away from the thick of the fighting that's happening between the pro-Russian separatists and the Ukrainians who want to keep their country together. And what we do here is we spend most of our time with like a 10-year-old boy and his friend and his grandmother as they kind of go through their daily life, hanging out in bomb shelters when the guns start, going to school where they get lectures from soldiers. And the kids raise their hand and they all know the different types of mines to avoid. And so it's this really interesting daily life type of film where over the course of it, as it proceeds for months, you see Oleg and his friends become kids shaped by living in eternal stress. You see the stress on the faces of him, of his classmates. You see them start to act out, to torture frogs. You see them become numb to the sound of bullets, which is almost worse than them flinching at the sound of bullets. You know, it's again, a very grim documentary.
Yeah. It's set over the course of a year, I think from 2014 to 15, so right after the fighting first erupted on the eastern part of Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. And it still goes on, not to the degree that is depicted in the film, but it is really a devastating, crippling look at the loss of innocence. If you watch the Polish film first and then you watch this one, as I did, you won't feel very good about yourself. It really takes the wind out of you. The issue here that I have, is the one of interference by the documentarians, and it's a slightly different one. It's not that they're manipulating the structure of the film. It's that individual moments in it feel overly staged. There are scenes where suddenly there's an insert shot and there's a reverse shot and people are conversing, and it's almost as if it was shot like a narrative film. And it's still spontaneous, but there is a feeling that the filmmakers were perhaps manipulating the situations a little bit in order to give them more narrative heft within the overall framework of the film. I can't confirm that, but just the way that it was shot, it certainly has that feeling. So it took me out of it a little bit.
And what about the boy, Oleg, the 10-year-old who's at the center of this film? How does he come across as he's living these traumatic experiences?
Incredibly detached. In a very strange way.
He's also a boy. You know, she makes sure to capture those moments where he and his friends are just doing backflips off the bed where they're playing and running around. You see, he feels like a real kid to me. He feels like a real kid.
But they're also accepting the conflict as part of their daily normal routine. And that's what's so troubling, is that this is now something they've come to expect. And it's a normal part of life.
So their coping mechanism is to normalize it.
Yeah.
It's all they really know, you know, which I think the film does a good job of establishing. Like when this is really most of their memory that they've ever had is living with this tension.
And how do the parents deal with, you know, the relationship with the boy? How does that come across?
Well, his parents are no longer there. I mean,
they're gone.
Okay. Yeah, they're gone. They visit his mother's grave very early on in the film, which, you know, his grandmother's there talking to him and he copes with that as well incredibly well. That's the thing, is that for a kid who's had so much death and tragedy and misery in his life, and where it's an ongoing daily affair, he really does seem hardened to it. And I wasn't sure quite how to take that, whether or not it was truly a coping mechanism, or whether or not he was just damaged, or perhaps somewhere between the two.
Or in a way, maybe it's slightly uplifting. Like he's figured out just how to accept things and try to keep going forward every day.
Perhaps.
The Distant Barking of Dogs, a Danish documentary which takes the moviegoer to eastern Ukraine, the experiences of 10-year-old Ukrainian Oleg as he goes through the experiences of conflict and battle around him. Simon Lering Vilmont is the director of the film. It's unrated. It's also one of the 15 shortlisted Academy Best Feature Documentary films under consideration. It's at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. both Saturday and Sunday this weekend, as well as Saturday and Sunday next weekend. And it's at the AMC Sunset on January 5th and January 8th. So that's Saturday and early next week. Just real briefly, wanted to ask you, we have about a minute before we break. So these are two of the 15 shortlisted docs. I don't know if you've seen any of the others, but
a lot of them.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Amy, how's this year stacking up for docs?
You know, I think it's interesting that we don't have that runaway crowd pleaser, you know, that just makes you feel good and everybody rolls their eyes because they don't want it to win, but it probably will. The closest thing we have to that is probably like Free Solo.
Well, no, the Mr. Rogers.
The
doc.
Fred Rogers
oh,
one.
I forgot
yeah.
about that one. Then
yeah,
I take,
won't you be
I
my
take
neighbor?
Back everything
yeah.
I say because I hope that doesn't win.
Yeah.
it is a very good field. My favorite is obviously On Her Shoulders, but that's incredibly brutal. That's darker and tougher to watch than either of these, but I also think more interesting.
All right, we'll continue with our Film Week critics. We have more features that are opening this week to talk about. Also, we're going to revisit the notable films that are in theaters right now that you probably want to see as you prepare to go down possible Oscar-nominated films. Make sure you're up to date on those. Back in 1 minute on Film Week. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week, Wade Major and Amy Nicholson. Next up, State Like Sheep, a U.S.-Canadian co-production. A mystery starring Catherine Waterston, Michael Shannon, and Luke Evans. It's written and directed by Meredith Danluck. Amy, what do you think of State Like Sheep?
State Like Sleep. It
Sleep, excuse me.
State Like Sheep, I see that too.
Counting sheep to go to sleep. All
if
right.
I put sheep in this movie, I might like it better. Catherine Waterston, people might know her face from showing up in Alien Covenant. You know, she's a very tall, stork-like, cropped hair, brunette.
Sam Waterston's daughter.
Exactly. She's yes. got like this kind of intelligent baby face that I like to look at a lot. This film did not do it for me very much, but what it's about is she plays a widow who a year ago, her husband, who was a very famous Belgian celebrity and actor, dies. And so a year later, she's been trying to avoid this, moving on with her life, going back to America, where she's from, when her mother and her mother-in-law, who do not get along, her mother-in-law's very prickly, are cleaning up the apartment because she's refusing to take care of their things. And then her mother gets a stroke, which is why she's like forced to go to Belgium and be stuck there. While she's stuck there, she starts to kind of figure out things about her husband's death that you sense she was avoiding, although this all unfolds so slowly that by the time it gets momentum at the end where like she starts spending more time with her husband's sinister best friend, Luke Evans, you're surprised that the plot suddenly has momentum when for an hour she's just been walking around doing that kind of like monotone acting that looks really deep. I was really excited to see this. I will say that because my second favorite actor, or maybe tied for first favorite actor, Michael Shannon, is in here.
I was expecting you to have good things to say about him.
He does show up. He has sort of a crazy character as an American businessman who is staying in the hotel room next to hers, who hires a lot of prostitutes and just decides he wants to win her over too. There's an arc with him that I did not buy at all, but I do enjoy seeing him around. He does his Michael Shannon thing very well here.
Stayed like sheep, Wade.
Yeah.
You did it again.
Like sleep. I can't believe my problem.
It's a tongue twister. That
State like sheep. Sleep.
Somewhere out there is someone who's going to make a movie now called State Like Sheep.
Yeah, sure.
And in about a year,
in
about a year and a half, we'll all be sitting here and we'll be reviewing it. And we'll like it. A lot better than this one. I agree with everything that Amy just said. This felt like it's a Canadian-American co-production, but as soon as you realize that it's taking place in Brussels, which is where, you know, the husband is Belgian and they have a flat in Brussels, and I started thinking, it's a tax shelter movie. This is the way things work. Anytime a movie shows up in Belgium, it's because someone's getting a tax break for investing in it, and that's just where this movie went. And so
have so many theories this week.
Well, I know I do, but it's that's just how these movies work. And then I started kind of looking at, oh, okay, so they got Michael Shannon, and they got her, and that's how it was all pieced together. And it just doesn't work. It's one of those wannabe noir scripts that knows how to create mood, but it has absolutely no idea how to pay off its setups.
I do want to say, though, that the cinematography is gorgeous. The costuming is gorgeous. Yeah, it's a really neon. Good-looking film.
It's dark and neon-inflected. You can't go wrong.
And Luke Evans is great. I'm happy to see those two guys show up. I'd like to watch the Michael Shannon Luke Evans running around doing their own In Bruges movie. That would be really happy.
State Like Sleep is a Canadian-U.S. co-production at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Mojin, the Worm Valley Chinese action-adventure film. Fei Xing is the director, Wade.
You know, back in 2015, when I reviewed Monster Hunt on this show, I thought the Chinese industry has completely jumped the shark. They're just making, they're not even trying anymore. And since then, they keep making bigger and bigger sharks. It's unbelievable. I love the original genre, the wuxia genre that informs these movies, at least when it was done in Taiwan and in Hong Kong. The way they're doing them now in China makes no sense. It just completely belittles the literary genre and all the antecedents. This is one of these wannabe Indiana Jones Raiders of the Lost Ark type adventures where there's some, 1,000 years ago, some empress put a curse on people that is inherited. They have a mark on them, and the only way to get rid of it is to find this weird artifact that's like a dinosaur bone wrapped around jade or something. And so a modern group of adventurers called together from the top young stars in the Chinese film industry are all thrown together, and they experience a magical journey that makes no sense. They reinvent the rules every 10 minutes and keep introducing stuff that makes no sense. And it just gets – it's more and more CGI, and it made no sense to me at all.
Yeah, it's wall-to-wall CG. It's unreal, which makes it feel both gigantic and also kind of cheap at the same time. I mean, they're fighting – what they're fighting is just like big lizards, big crabs, you know?
It's just so stupid.
Yeah, it's very, very dumb. I mean, it feels to me like they're more operating in the key of like Journey to the Center of the Earth or Jumanji. They're not even trying for art.
All the above.
I wouldn't say there's even like a frame in here that you would freeze frame and be like, that looks beautiful or real or anything. It's more just like the action is kind of choppy, or it's just people leaping around in slow motion.
Yeah.
And there's one character who on her deathbed gives this little passive aggressive speech that made me happy she died. I mean, so even the emotions are just all over the place.
It has a 14-minute prologue to explain all the characters and all the rules, and even then it makes no sense.
Mojin, the Worm Valley Chinese action adventure film. It's at the AMC Atlantic Times Square in Monterey Park and the AMC Puente Hills. It's unrated. And finally, American Hangman, a Canadian drama starring Donald Sutherland and Vincent Kartheiser. It's written and directed by Wilson Conybeare. Wade?
This is just one escape room, but it deals with a lot of the same general themes, which is, you know, man's inhumanity to man, and when, you know, are we really as civilized as we think we are, and how fragile our legal system is. Yeah, not giving away too much, there's a strange man who has kidnapped a couple of people. One of whom is Donald Sutherland, and locked them up in this basement, and then it puts them on social media trial. And this is supposed to call into question all of our inadequacies and the failings of our legal system and our humanity. And, you know, basically we're just cavemen still pretending to be sophisticated people, which is a really interesting discussion. And it's interesting when it takes place in the room between those characters. When it goes outside to the world, the reporters, the people who are watching in the bars, that's where it starts to feel a little bit phony.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. There's a containment here that I was on board with for a while, and then it starts to hinge on a past murder, which just becomes incredibly dull and confusing the more they explain it. You're like, let's go back to the room. Let's spend more time in this room. But they're like, no,
in that conversation.
What happened here?
Yeah,
it just becomes incredibly, incredibly talky and disappointing. Yeah.
American Hangman is at the Galaxy Mission Grove in Riverside, and it's unrated. Now, with so many big films still in theaters that were released just before year's end for Oscar consideration, we want to take an opportunity to revisit some of those movies. And we begin with one beloved by Wade, but he's hardly alone in the critical community. The Favorite from director Yorgos Lanthimos, the film starring Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, and Rachel Weisz.
This is an absolutely brilliant film. I am not a fan normally of Yorgos Lanthimos. He always felt to me a little bit in the Lars von Trier, Jean-Luc Godard vein of I'm just going to be weird and eccentric.
So you're the only other person didn't like The Lobster with
I really didn't like The Lobster.
Oh, wow, I'm outnumbered? That's fine. I'll just be here being correct in the corner.
But here he's hamstrung with great material, and that's a good thing because it forces him to put all of his energies and his eccentric weirdness into the service of an amazing amazing story. And the story of the story is great. It takes place, you know, it's the 18th century story of Queen Anne and her court intrigue between her advisor and her advisor's cousin. And it's just an amazing story that goes in there with Tom Jones and Barry Lyndon and Dangerous Liaisons. And it's eccentric and it's funny and shocking and surprising. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I absolutely adore this. We here at LAFCA, Wade and I, Olivia Colman is our best actress this year.
She's fantastic.
She's an actress that I've just adored forever, and she plays the queen. And it's just this terrific performance that I've never seen Yorgos direct before, because Yorgos tends to have his actors be a little bit mask-like to deliver his lines, to make the emphasis all about the ideas that they're fighting with. But she is the most human, messy, sloppy, fabulous construction. Your emotions for her change day to day. Like, it's this terrific performance. And the question that the film is really pursuing, you know, it's a little bit more subtle than what I think he's mostly interested in. You know, this is a film that plays like just a cutthroat battle for the queen's affection, but it's really about how does the queen herself want to be loved by both of these women.
Mm-hmm.
One of the women, Rachel Weisz, offers her a really strict, tough love. When the queen looks like a badger, she tells her she looks like a badger. The other one, Emma Stone, is all flattery, and she toggles between them the two. And I think that's a really fascinating question.
Like two little sitting on her shoulders, you know.
Exactly. I love that.
This was a screenplay written by a first-time screenwriter, Deborah Davis, 20 years ago, when she just thought that this was a really interesting story. And it's taken 20 years to make it to the screen. There's another screenwriter credited, Tony McNamara, who this seems to be kind of a Shakespeare in Love thing, where, you know, someone else's script was handed off to someone else over the course of time. But you know what? That process has given us an amazing script. It's the best screenplay of the year by none. By far. There are lines here that you will quote until the end of time. It's that good.
The Favorite is rated R. It's in select theaters. Also, the animated feature Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which has had rave reviews and is giving The Incredibles 2 a run for money for possible best animated feature. Wade?
Yeah, this just was a real surprise. I didn't expect this at all. It's aggressively animated in a really, really exciting way. It takes the energy of the comic book, and it puts it on screen. It says we're not going to just kind of give you a filmed version of a comic book. We're going to bring the comic book to life with its frames, with its extreme angles, with everything that makes a comic book different from real life. We're going to celebrate that in animation. And they do it in an incredibly engaging way.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, rated PG in select theaters. Shoplifters, the Japanese drama written and directed by Horokazu Kurita. It's rated R. Amy?
This is one of the films that's going to really give Roma some competition in the foreign language department. What it's about is a makeshift family that's been assembled and lives on thievery. And you watch as the young children, a little girl who's been newly brought in because her parents were abusing her and leaving her out on the porch, and a younger boy who's been living with them for a while, realize what their life truly is. And maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, and sort of fighting with it. Like, you wind up really knowing every individual in this family as individuals, appreciating them together, wondering if them being together is the correct thing. It's a film that just grows and grows and grows, and it seems very quiet, but you are absolutely hooked.
Shoplifters, the Japanese drama. It's in selected theaters. Cold War, Poland's official submission for the foreign language Oscar. We're just mentioning Roma, of course, in Spanish and from Mexico and the Japanese film Shoplifters, Cold War, Amy.
Yeah, this film has been doing so well here. I've been doing Q&As with the lead actress, Joanna Kulig, over at the Royal for the last 2 weekends, and it has been sold out crowds. It's fantastic. And this is the weekend
because they're coming to see you.
Hi. And this is the weekend where Cold War is actually moving closer to the east side. It's going to be playing in Hollywood at the Arclight. So for people who didn't want to drive to Santa Monica, please go see this. It's a romance between a young singer and her older mentor that transcends decades, it transcends countries, and it transcends any sense of logic because they love each other, they're mad about each other, they can't find a way to be happy.
I love this film, and I like it more than Ida, which was Pawlikowski's previous film, also shot in black and white. Yeah, I think this is – it's kind of a flip side to Beale Street in many respects. It's a beautiful film.
And quickly, we're talking about Cold War, by the way, the Polish film from Paweł Pawlikowski, which is rated R in selected theaters. If Beale Street Could Talk, Wade.
Yeah,
Barry Jenkins' film.
Absolutely wonderful follow up to
Moonlight.
Which I think is actually better than Moonlight for my money. I think Beale Street is poetry. It's Barry Jenkins has always talked about how influenced he is by foreign language films, and if you look at this and you really take it apart and you realize that yes, it's Barry Jenkins doing James Baldwin, but it also feels like a Bertolucci film. It's shot like a Bertolucci film. The character relationships feel like a Bertolucci film. It has a certain elegance and a melancholy poetry to it that just sort of carries you away. It's a beautiful movie.
Sounds terrific. Those are just a few of the films that you can see in theaters now that our critics want to point you toward. And in the coming weeks, hope you get a chance to see them. Coming up right after our break, we're going to take you to theater at Ace Hotel for the post-screening conversation after The Artist, the best picture of just a few years ago. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite. Nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Screenplay, and Best Picture of the Year. Also nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Best Picture, and one of AFI's 10 Best Pictures of the Year, for consideration in all categories.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Several weeks ago, we did our most recent Film Week screening at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We showed The Artist, the 2011 Best Picture. And after we showed the film, I talked with Hollywood historian and film consultant Mark Wanamaker, as well as our Film Week critics Leah Lowenstein and Wade Major. And I asked Wade where he first saw the film and why it had such a big effect on him.
I saw it just at a regular press screening. I've been looking forward to it, obviously, because I'm a huge fan of Michel Hazanavicius, all the way back to his OSS 117 spy spoofs, the first of which, Cairo Nest of Spies, was this exact trio of people. I was looking forward to it, obviously, because of the history interested me. My father was from this era. My father had an acting school and a theater. So, I mean, I grew up hearing this history, hearing these people. Hearing about that transition. My father taught silent actors how to speak for the talkies, like you hear in Singing in the Rain. So I wanted to see the movie, and I saw it, and it floored me because it captured everything that I had seen in the movies, everything I'd been told about this era. And this is one of the only two films I've ever seen where I felt like that's your Best Picture winner, the second the credits rolled. And the other was Slumdog Millionaire.
Mark, you grew up here in Hollywood as Wade did, I did as well. How well do you feel this captures this transitional area of film?
Gosh, this is an emotional film for me because I know a lot about Doug Fairbanks, and many of you might. And there was I guess you can encapsulate this in one famous story in which Doug, it was in 1929, and Doug was at his studio, and he had lunch with this writer, and then they went out to a sound stage. Standing there looking at all the activity going on, he was speechless. His friend said, you don't look well, and what's wrong? He says, and he was motioning his head saying, it's over, it's over for me. He says, what do you mean it's over for you? What are you talking about? In other words, what Doug was saying to himself, just like in this film, he didn't fit in to this new sound era. He was a shell of himself by the time he died in 1939.
And the big, I mean, you're talking the biggest silent star around.
That's right. And it's emotional in the sense that the whole film is iconic, relating to the end of an era, and it's just like now, the end of film and the beginning of digital.
Wait,
the thing that's most interesting about this part of film history is that if you go to 1927, January of 1927, you go through all the old magazines, the photo plays, and all those fan magazines, and you look at the movies that were a hit. Every single person who was a movie star, who was big, who was huge, you know, whose faces appeared on marquees and billboards larger than life, 5 years later, they were gone, and they were replaced by an entirely new generation. It was an extraordinary turnaround in just 5 short years. And it speaks to how difficult that transition was. And the ones who made it were typically the character actors, right? The second leads, the guys who were coming out of vaudeville, who were just supporting and who maybe had a good voice from radio. But the stars, the ones who had faces, they were the ones that couldn't make the transition. And that's really extraordinary. That's unprecedented.
One of the things I like, though, about the artist is that in George's character, he's not sentimentalized. I mean, his ego, his vanity, this is all very upfront. So it's not like just poor George. Like, he's as much his own enemy as an industry that's changed. It's like it's lured him in to believing he really is this star who's never going to age out, only to be unable to make the transition.
And that's why I think you see so many images of these busts, these paintings, this is a film about representation. And the painting that represents him is larger than life, that he takes seriously, that's sort of kind of preposterous how ridiculous he looks in the painting. You also see a tremendous amount of stairways ups and downs, comings and goings. So this is a film about representation, about the passage of legacy, of fame, and I think really for George, it's about letting go and accepting change.
Mark, how in a film like this, where everything has to look right, the language needs to fit, the costuming, if you're consulting on a film like this, I understand you had input on this one. What are the kinds of things that good directors and other crew members are asking of you?
Well, for a period film like this, the main idea is just to bring the audience into the period. You get lost in the period of it. If you see things that are more modern, then you start to lose that image, you know, that false front, you might say. But it has to be accurate. One other thing on the sets, so we could talk for hours, but there's one thing I noticed. There was a shot of Calvin Coolidge in the back.
Right. Yeah.
And there's also Tamara Lampica paintings everywhere, if you notice that. Tamara Lampica is the time of the late 20s, the early 30s. I mean, all these little details, it helps to create this atmosphere.
Right down to the cut of his suits. When you first see him, that three-piece suit is such a perfect tailored 20s suit. And later on, he's wearing just kind of a loose off-the-rack suit that somebody would grab just at a dime store. And even his ties, you know, tied in a half Windsor. Today, most people tie a full Windsor. No, it was a half Windsor back then. And those very kind, the design, the texture, just a little bit glittery.
No,
it's amazing.
I did read, though, that the film canisters were not actually authentic because they would have been square at the time, not round. Mm. And that was a concession to what looked better visually.
It's odd that a French man born and raised as the writer-director of this film, the stars are French. They come to Hollywood, Los Angeles, make this movie here. Why is it we didn't have an American make a movie like this first?
Well, it's odd and yet not at all odd in a way. First of all, I think if an American had made this film, it wouldn't have won the acclaim that it had. It wouldn't have been taken seriously. The French have a long history of loving and praising American film, going all the way back to André Bazin in the 30s and 40s, writing about Orson Welles and Howard Hawks and being really recontextualizing those filmmakers in a way that brought them new praise. And then François Truffaut, of course, advanced that with the theory of auteurs. And then Romare and Chabrol, the filmmakers who wrote about Hitchcock. So there's a long history of the French loving and praising American film in a way that then brings it back to us so then we can appreciate it. Because we didn't actually understand or appreciate the auteur theory until the French came out with it.
It's remarkable, too. This is the first silent film and only the second silent film ever to win Best Picture since 1927, the first year of the Academy Awards. But it's also the only film made officially by a non-English-speaking country to ever win Best Picture. Everything else was either Hollywood-produced or British. And it's rather extraordinary, and they celebrated it in France, too. This is the only film in history that has ever won the César and the Oscar Best Picture winners.
Let's go back to Los Angeles of the 1920s. You know, when this theater was built, Broadway was largely developed, and there was a population boom. We tend to think of the post-World War II era, and of course that was an enormous population boom. But that era of the 20s of American affluence also led many people to come to Los Angeles. The film industry, the oil industry, people forget, this is a big oil town back in that era. A lot of money that was coming into Los Angeles. And Wade, you know, speak to that as the movie industry is growing from the mid-teens through the 20s.
Well, it's transforming everything that Los Angeles was. This was, you know, it was agriculture, it was oil, it was a few other things, lots of ranches. But as the movie people came here, there were two things that really drew them to Los Angeles. One was lots of wide open land. You can build studios, and it's relatively inexpensive. It's not overbuilt like the East was, where the film industry was in New York. But weather. You know, it's great year-round weather, and you can go anywhere, and you can, you know, within it's this extraordinary geologic range where you could go to mountains, you could get oceans, you could get snow, you know, you could shoot something that took place in the Himalayas, you could shoot something that took place in the Sahara, and it could all be shot in L.A. And it was amazing. And there's no other part of the world that lends itself to that diversity. It's like this area was kissed by God to make movies.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We're listening to the recent post-screening conversation from our Film Week screening of The Artist. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're listening to a conversation from a few weeks ago at Theater at Ace Hotel. It's our most recent Film Week screening, and we chose The Artist. With me in conversation, film historian Mark Wanamaker and our Film Week critics Wade Major and Lael Lowenstein. I asked Lael about the score of the film. You know, in silent films, sound is still extremely important because the score of those films, often played in large cities by a large orchestra, smaller towns, it might just be a pianist who's playing along with the film. But the music is very important, of course, for the mood and giving you a sense of anticipation as scenes change. This film, Lael, score, critically acclaimed, of course, the Academy honored it as well. And what I liked about it were the combination of the original elements and pastiche. I thought that Ludovic did a great job of interweaving those.
Yes, and you're right, Larry. There was some controversy at the time because it did borrow certain passages from other films, including Vertigo, and was initially criticized for adopting those without attribution. But what they did was they said, you know, look, this film is an homage. This is a Valentine to our industry, and it's got passages that you may recognize, but it's also got original pieces as well. And so I think in the end, that's what won the Oscar for it, is the fact that they were able to make the case that there was enough that was original. And in fact, this is the best of L.A., right, which is to acknowledge the past, to have a nostalgia-infused Valentine to it, and that's what this is.
Newman in Monrovia asks, what about the trends or expectations of the 1920s regarding the business practices, the style of the movie industry? So we have John Goodman's, you know, character as the mogul of the studio. Mark, maybe you could start. You know, how much of this was like a single individual, you know, running the studio?
It's true. In those early days, this is pre-corporate era, we had these individuals who come from different places, not even born in the United States, Louis B. Mayer and others. Jesse Lasky was born in the U.S., but Adolf Zukor and William Fox, et cetera, they were sort of the auteur of the studio system. They were the head of it. They made all the decisions. Sure, they hired people to deal with production and all this. They didn't get involved with that sometimes. Mayer did. But a lot of the time, they made all these decisions. And I guess it comes boils down to one word, business. And the business dictates what is going on at the studios. And when you think about it, at the end of this, I think it was around the 60s when the studios were, remember when MGM by 1970 was giving up their lots and all these moguls were gone already. And it was this new corporate era coming in. And boy, did things change. And I was a witness to all of this, and it changed quickly as well.
Yeah. Lael, your thoughts on the business at the time?
To my mind, it's a fairly authentic representation of what the studio system was like during that time. I mean, you're Daryl Zanucks, your Zukors, your Harry Cohns, these guys who are larger than life, ironically finding an echo in some ways in the Harvey Weinsteins of recent years, not in all the ways, but just in the way that he was extremely controlling and had an artistic perspective that was important to him.
John Goodman is a rose-colored representation of what those guys were really like. my father worked for Jack Warner. I heard a lot of very colorful Jack Warner stories growing up, none of which are appropriate for this stage. And the thing that does come through here is definitely that thing, the control, the unbelievable autonomy that they had. But the thing that was really remarkable about all those figures, all the moguls, is they knew their limitations. They knew at what point they had to say, I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm going to delegate it to you. And it's now on your head. And if you screw it up, your head's going to roll, but I'm going to let you run with it. And there's something really remarkable about that. You know, you don't really get that anymore. Now we have a corporate culture where everything is so fragmented and it's so democratized that nobody's responsible for anything. And these guys, especially, you know, when you get to the Harry Cohns and the Jack Warners, who were, you know, the SOBs of the day, they were the ones, or even Louis B. Mayer, they would just lay it on everybody else's head. I'm going to hand it all into you, but you have, if you don't deliver, I'm going to cut you loose. I'm going to cut your head off.
And again, as Mark said, it's so ironic. These are all immigrants.
Yeah.
But who are giving such a representation of what America is on screen?
Well, because they came from, and again, this is, you know, Neil Gabler's book, An Empire of Their Own, speaks very much to that pipeline of persecuted Eastern European Jews who came here and took advantage of what was a sort of delegitimized industry in the late 19th century. It was carny folk, right? It was, you know, Nickelodeons, all this weird stuff. Who wants to be involved in that? Theater is the real prestige. And these guys saw something. They saw the future. They were looking forward. And they forged it into something other than just a nickel attraction at a carnival or a vaudeville extension. They forged it into a new industry. They were forward thinking. They were the sort of digital pioneers of their day, to get back to that, you know, analogy. And they were visionaries. But again, they knew their limitations. They knew where they had to call it quits.
You know, Larry, another thing about that question, when you think about these guys, these Jewish immigrant moguls. Many of them were not Jewish immigrant moguls in the earliest days. It was Vitagraph and Biograph, Edison, all those companies. The difference is that the Jewish companies persevered and they survived to this day. The others did not. Why? Because they represented to the people, that they wanted people to see their films, and to this day it's always to the people. In the other days of Edison, etc., they were doing moral stories a lot, but
not audience-driven?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They were not audience-driven. And the other studios that survived were more audience-driven.
Let's talk about the screenplay, which was Oscar-nominated. Wade, your thoughts on how Ozzie and Odysseus you know, brought all these different elements together and is telling both the larger scale story with the intimate one.
Well, when he pitched this originally, he didn't pitch it with a screenplay. He pitched it with something that's even beyond, you know, some people may be familiar with lookbooks. That's the new thing, right? You'll make a sort of a promotional document for your movie filled with photographs and other graphics. But he had basically a graphic novel of this story so that it was visual. Because he wanted to communicate the fact that this is about the pictures, this is about the imagery, this is about what pictures do for you. And in the silent era, it was all about pictures. And that's what sold it. And people were just sort of wowed by it at the time. And I think the wisdom of that is that he was able to communicate in a very simple way the emotions of the story. It's not all about the structure and the, you know, the callbacks and the references and all the usual technical things that you... But no, it's about the emotion between those two characters. The one scene in here that everyone always remembers are those multiple takes of the dancing sequence, because it's two people falling in love on screen before your eyes in take after take after take, and they're the takes that aren't used, that he saves... I mean, forget about the rest of the movie. There's something so pure about that, so beautiful and poetic about that. And, you know, when you have just a handful of moments like that that you can communicate to people, your movie's going to get made. It's about those moments. If you can bring people to tears, and apparently he did when he was pitching this around, that's the mark of a great story.
I hope you've enjoyed our post-screening conversation. We showed The Artist. I had so much fun talking with film historian Mark Wanamaker about it, as well as our Film Week critics, Leah Lowenstein and Wade Major. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.